Hello and welcome to another episode of Bringing Design Closer. My name is Jerry Scullion and I'm a service designer and I'm the founder of This Is HCD and also CEO of This Is Doing, a live class design and innovation company providing training in the skills of service designers, design researchers, product managers, user experience designers and much, much more. Now, you're in for a real treat in this episode. Let me tell you a little bit of a story though. In a previous life, I had dreams of becoming a musician. I know. Now, I was a singer-songwriter and had a band, and reflecting back now, it was some of the best experiences and times of my life. Now, I've played music from the age of 4 and started writing music from the age of 12. So for me, design and music were part of the same mindset. And it wasn't until earlier this year that I was out for dinner with a friend and mentioned how I see huge similarities between design and music that I realized that not everybody sees this. Now let me tell you, the musical mindset is something that designers can and should embrace more of. There are so many layers to this mindset, from creating music being a team sport, needing rhythm and cadence and excitement. You need talent, but you also need the dedication and confidence to explore and embrace the unknown in the live format. Music is created in a studio, very much like a designer's studio, but it's how the songs and music perform in the live arena that they start to become a living and breathing things. Yeah, I hope you're starting to see some similarities with services here. Designing services and creating music are so similar. There's an obvious metaphor to lift Patrick Quattlebaum and Chris Risdon's wonderful book of orchestrating, but there is so much more to it than that. Just creating a song from the moment of jamming in a studio or working alone is like creating an outline of a thing, and over time it's iterated and iterated upon and often tested to get live feedback from people. See the similarities? And it's refined and refined until you go into the studio to record it and lay it down. Well, that was the process that worked for me up until 2006. Now, in this episode, I connect with a former producer that I was lucky enough to work with way back in 2006 to 2008, Mr. Rafa Sardina, 60-time Grammy-nominated, 15-time winner. And he has a client list that looks like the most celebrated artists of the last 100 years that include Michael Jackson, Lady Gaga, Dr. Dre, Beyonce, Stevie Wonder, Celine Dion, and everybody's favourite singer, Susan Boyle. Now, we chat about how the craft of songwriting has evolved from the early 90s up until the present day, and what working with Michael Jackson looked like, as well as Prince, and how the industry validates songs. We chat about how technology disrupted and ultimately killed the large recording budgets that ultimately ran for months or years in some instances, and to where Rafa is currently now, mid-pandemic, producing globally via live recording sessions in the top studios in the world. Let's get straight into this episode. Rafa Sardina, a very warm welcome to Bringing Design Closer. How are you?
Doing good. How are you doing?
I'm not so bad. I'm doing okay. Like, you know, we've been chatting for half an hour here before we started recording, everybody. I've known Rafa for a very long time. And in a previous life, I played in music and I was lucky enough to cross paths with Rafa and we worked together, Rafa as a producer and me as an artist. And in this episode, we're going to be speaking a little bit more around the interconnectedness between music creation and design. It's a great topic. And for people who don't know Rafa Sardina, Rafa Sardina is a 60-time Grammy nominated producer and a 15-time award winner. Okay, I'm sure you never get sick of hearing that. But Rafa, let us start. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Well, my main focus in my career has been music, mainly. I not only do music, I have other interests too, but my main focus has been creating music, you know, working on music as a producer, engineer, as a mixer, which is another super, super creative aspect of the music creation process. And I've been doing it for almost 30 years, if not 30. But over the years, I developed many other interests. One of them is wine. Another one, technology. You know, I love technology. I love not just gadgets or to create a piece of hardware or software for a specific use, but the whole ergonomy of things, you know, how it's going to be used by the end users, and even how is it going to be used unexpectedly by the not so-called pro users, but the incidental users, you know.
your interests. But like how I know you is as a music producer and a mixer and an engineer. And I remember going out a couple of nights out when I was in Los Angeles with you many years ago, and we had some great stories, and we're going to share some of those stories today in this episode. So tell us a little bit more about how you got your break in music production, if you can remember that far back.
No, I do remember that far back. I had my first studio experience also incidentally when I was only 15, 16 years old. I was part of a full recording session in a real professional recording studio back in Spain. And that really, you know, it was an eye-opening experience for me. Because I never thought the studio could be such a creative environment, you know, to basically change your music, not just record your music. Up to that point, I thought that a recording studio was just that, exactly, literally. I was just interpreting what the name said, you know, recording a studio, you record music. And I realized it wasn't just that. It was a place where you can create the right environment to create, not specifically record, but you can create, you can, you know, songwrite, you can produce. That's when my eyes opened to production too. So from that point on, I became super, super interested in that aspect.
Yeah.
But I had some abilities, you know, with the whole recording process and mixing and balancing things. So I used that path in order to, in later years, you know, achieve, you know, my production status, you know, to start like really helping artists, you know, achieve their goal.
But you're a musician as well. I remember you're an accomplished guitarist as well. So
yeah, I play guitar, and that was my original dream, to tell you the truth. I wanted to be an artist. I mean, that was it. That's what that everything started. I wanted to be an artist. But then I discovered production, and I discovered engineering, and I discovered all of those other aspects. But initially, I just wanted to be an artist.
And for anyone, like, I'm going to have to try and do a screen grab, because Rafa's studio in Los Angeles is insane. I remember walking into it, and the amount of gear in his studio is just, it's breathtaking. It's such a beautiful studio. But, you know, you got your break, we're speaking in the early 90s, was it, in Ocean Way Studios in Los Angeles? And when I remember walking into your studio with a guitar and, you know, literally like, hey, play your songs. And, you know, I'd researched, but I hadn't researched as much as I probably should have. Like, you have worked with everyone in your career, like Michael Jackson, Prince, like you name it, Rafa has, you know, had experience working with that artist. So what I'm really keen to chat about, I guess, is more the creative process. So how it's changed from that era of the early 90s to, you know, the mid 2000s and to where we're at now at the moment. As a songwriter myself back in the day, you know, what we used to do is when I had a band, we'd get into a room and we'd jam and we'd create sounds and interesting things. And I actually had a Spanish guitarist as well, like, you know, from the wonderful world of Madrid, and he was equally as crazy as me, and we'd come up with some stuff, and I got there's something in that, and we would go through that process, and then we'd go into a studio and we'd lay it down, as you said, a recording studio. And we didn't really think of the recording studio as an instrument in itself, like, you know. And it wasn't until I guess I got to work with yourself and Cheche that I experienced that, how you could take a sketch and make it into a fully formed product, I guess, I suppose, was like an artifact. How have you seen the evolution of the creative songwriting process change over the years?
I think that it has changed because of technology, because of the existence of the internet, because of the distancing between the different players in any project. By players, I mean it could be anything, songwriters, producers, arrangers. It used to be that we had to get together to collaborate. And now that's not the case anymore. We can be wherever we want and still collaborate. And the technology to do it is getting better and better. You know, we're getting rid of latency. We have better, you know, tools to do it. AI is going to further change it big time.
Yeah.
Soon enough, that's going to happen.
We're at that point where you believe there's something is about to change. Which we're definitely going to get to in the conversation. But what I'd really like to, if you can hone your mind back to the era of, say, when you got to work with Michael Jackson at that point, when he entered into the studio, were songs created at that stage? Were they fully formed things? Or walk me through what that was like.
Depending on the stage of the project, and it happened with many artists back then, some of those projects will take a full year to be realized. And I'm talking like a full year of 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. I'm not talking like, oh, it took him a year, but then he's only working like 3 days a month, right? No. It was like, 6 days a week for a full year. And depending on the, you know, where the stage of the project, where were you at? But even the whole pre-production could take months. And the whole recording process for each one of the songs, for each one of the tracks could take 6 months or 9 months. Wow. Who knows? But it also happened that way because we were allowed to work that way. Budgets allowed for that. But it has been proven, you know, not that later on, even after, you know, 9/11, when the whole, there was a big shift in the industry in terms of budgets and the time slots that you could use, you know, to work on a project. You know, what used to take 3 weeks, it was condensed down to 2 days. That's the reality. So that only meant that it could be done. It was a mixture of procrastination, but also, you know, people will just take the opportunity because you had it in front of you. I mean, I'm not saying that people were lazy. I mean, we work hard, but we took our time. We wouldn't make up our minds on things. We will experiment much more.
Yeah.
I miss the experimentation aspect of things. I do miss that part. But I don't miss procrastinating on decisions. That aspect, I'm glad it's over.
yeah, no, absolutely. Like the deliberation around a snare drum sound and...
Those kind of things. Because when you start procrastinating like that, you stop using your intuition. You work at a different level in terms of your...
creative process.
How you use your abilities. Yeah.
You get stuck down into the weeds of a snare drum. I remember, you know, I'm obviously a huge U2 fan. I don't know if you remember that, but I remember reading about where they recorded Where the Streets Have No Name. And Eno, I think they'd spent 6 months on Where the Streets Have No Name, like on that track, because it's got a strange time structure. And at one point, Eno instructed the engineer, the junior engineer, to take the tape and burn it. He was like, just get rid of it. He said, we'll start again. And they didn't do it. So like, in some ways, it's kind of good. In other ways, it's like, he was like, it's just crazy. We were like deliberating over everything, like, you know, snare sounds to hi-hats, to cymbals, everything, like, you know. But looking back at that that process where you said that there was lots of bigger budgets and a lot more time to spend and you were exploring a lot more. You know, what were the benefits of that? What were you seeing in being able to do that exploration process?
Well, one of the benefits was the human interaction. You had time to know each other, you know, that's one aspect. Even not just between the specific, you know, band members, if it was a band and the producer, but even you had time to hone that relationship within the band. You know, they got to know each other well. They got to really explore things so they could actually have a conversation at a different level. It wasn't just that frugal that, oh, we have an hour just to record these two tracks. It wasn't like that. There was more time to debate and to, you know, to talk about their own personal preferences and taste and whatnot. The disadvantage, as I mentioned earlier, sometimes you will kill intuition, the intuitive aspect of the process, because, you know, you had so much time to debate things that you start like rationalizing every single aspect about it. And to me, that was the negative aspect of it. But yeah, the good things were, you know, human interaction, how it could be honeyed, you know, you had more time to take care of that. And experimentation, you had more time to try things and fail. It is very important to fail.
Yeah.
It is essential to fail. Now we have very limited time to fail. I always take it into account, though. I always think when I'm talking about, you know, scheduling a project and people say like, oh, you need 2 hours for that, you need 1 hour for that, I always allocate some time for failure.
Yeah.
Because it is super important to me.
Yeah, no, absolutely, because it's, we're not robots at the end of the day. We can't be, you know, sliced, our time sliced up into little slots and say, I'm going to do 20 minutes on this piece and 20 minutes on that piece. You know, we don't work that way.
And it's the key to success. I mean, in order to come out with the with an amazing idea, sometimes you have to fail on two other.
Yeah, absolutely. But like the whole kind of design process and the music process for me, they're not linear. Okay, it's not a case of like, we'll do this and then we do that, we'll do this. It's very much like exploration, and then we kind of refine an exploration and maybe go back a couple of steps and then we'll jump forward a couple of steps. And like for me, as a novice songwriter, before I started recording properly, it was a case of like, I'll just do it and then I've done it and it's, the song is done. Whereas I started to learn a lot more around the craft of songwriting, whereas like I change things and I improvise, and improvisation was one of the bits that I like to think I started to get to that comfort level in, later when I was playing with other bands. But improvisation in the studio, I never got to that point where, you know, you hear these bands and they're just like, you know, you two has been a prime example when, people are going to really learn a lot more about me in this episode because I'm a huge YouTube fan. But when they went to Berlin to record Octone Baby, and they were literally just jamming and playing and playing and playing, it's where a lot of the sonic sounds at Edge came out of those sessions in what's the name of the studio where Bowie recorded. But improvisation in the studio. So what experience have you got when you reflect back in the early stages of the 90s when you were recording with all those big artists? How did improvisation affect the creative process?
It's all project dependent, because, and the style of music, it's...
Let's talk about Prince, because I know you worked with Prince. Let's talk about Prince.
I didn't actually work with him. I actually went to some jam sessions with him in his house. He used to do that, which really shows, you know, how important and nurturing it was for him in terms of personal growth. You know, he would just invite, you know, people he didn't even know, just based on recommendation. You know, a musician would recommend another musician or another producer, somebody that he knew that, you know, was supposed to be a legit kind of, you know, legit group of people. So he invited these people to his home.
Actually, why was he doing that, though? There was obviously his method to the madness. There was obviously a reason why Prince was bringing other people. Do you think he was trying to validate, or he's trying to get an understanding of what works and how getting people?
He was trying to grow personally. He was trying to be influenced by other people. He was trying to, I mean, that's what I took out of the experience. He was trying to rub against other younger musicians, younger people with different ideas, different ways of creating music, different ways of jamming.
Yeah.
And for him, he wouldn't talk much. He would just stay quiet. He wouldn't talk to anybody. It was funny, but he was watching. He was catching up. You know, he was just getting into somebody else's riff. He would play the drums. He would play the guitar. It only shows you that everybody needs that kind of interaction, that kind of growth, no matter how big they are.
Yeah.
No matter how big they are. You know, it's a never-ending learning process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Going back to that, in the 90s, and you said there was bigger budgets, so there was probably a little bit more leniency in terms of not having an album that was a straight success that was going to deliver, you know, top 10 hits and all that kind of stuff. Can you remember how singles were determined out of albums back then? Like, how did they select and say, okay, we've got three singles in this? Were, you know, were they doing it back then? How were they doing it as well?
Oh, it was done, obviously, the same as it is done today, but with a different level of importance, but or priority, let's say, not importance, but priority. But because now people are just releasing singles, period, right? They are not even recording albums. Once in a while, it doesn't even come up to that. But back then, the process was very different, because you will do it towards the end of the process, or when you will be like very, very advanced in the recording production process, and then you will pick the singles.
Okay, so they let them form, and then they
form. So some of those singles will reveal themselves. So it was a much easier process, you know.
Yeah.
To work out. Yeah.
And have you seen that shift, like in terms of in the present day?
I've seen the shift, because now it's just there is a different level of expectation. You don't get into the studio unless you know that song is going to be the single. So
really?
It's the other way around. With many new novel artists, that's the case. You work on two songs and either one or both need to be the singles, period. So in a way, it can be a little bit disappointing sometimes because it doesn't allow for growth. It doesn't allow for development during the process. I mean, you are stuck with what you got from the get-go. Yeah. From the get-go, you need to make it happen. That's why very often these days we go in circles with the same song or with the same songs, trying to make them, trying to overcome whichever obstacles we might have, make them appear to be singles, even if they are not.
Yeah. Do you know Rick Beato, the music producer? He's a YouTuber anyway. He has a great video of this Nashville songwriting process where I think it was 20 of the last, in the last 2 years, they all use the same four chords. I mean, exactly the same four chords. And they all sound exactly the same. When he splices them together, you couldn't tell them because we're just at that point of like...
Regurgitating
the same stuff. It's just like, yeah, that sounds good. That made us money. Let's keep going. And there's been very little innovation in music for that reason in itself. Like, you know, you touched on something there when the artist came into the studio and like they know that that's going to be the single. So around the early 2000s, I remember whenever Apple bought, was it eMagic? And it became GarageBand. And I remember I was chatting to you around when John Mayer, actually Steve Jobs brought John Mayer out with GarageBand and was like, hey, this is what you can do with GarageBand. And it changed my perception. And I was like, oh, maybe it's not a kid's toy anymore. Maybe it's actually, you could use this in the studio. So around that time, what kind of shift were you seeing? Like that was kind of where technology started to sort of introduce itself to the studio and the producers, I guess. Like, they were like, hey, you know, we've got some gear at home. How did that change the process for you?
It changed a lot. It really changed a lot because it allowed for artists to actually put down their own ideas on their own and be confident about it. Have tools that were like simple enough so that you could do it. Basically, GarageBand was a downsized version of Logic, right? Mm. And Logic, even though it can be quite intuitive, it was a very complex, very deep program. So most artists, most people without any previous technical, you know, skills, were very intimidated by those tools. So they wouldn't use them. So I think that programs like GarageBand, programs like Reason, all of this changed the whole game. Because it allowed artists to do things on their own. Not only that, they started doing things differently in a different kind of way. Like instead of following the usual steps, step one, you do this, you create the bass. Step two, you do this. Like they start like turning the whole thing around and not actually working on the beat until they got, you know, the flow of the song or something else. So it even changed songwriting for me, at least. The songwriting process changed completely. You will actually create something based on a beat, but later on you will change the beat. It only allow you to have like a rhythmic structure, but nothing else. It wasn't really the backbone of your song. It was just like a placeholder for you in order to get inspired.
Yeah.
You know, and write something. So it really changed at you know, at a mental level. I mean, in terms of how people understood the process inside their heads.
What was the conversation like in the industry at that stage when, you know, amongst your peers, they were like, have you seen GarageBand? Have you seen Reason? Like, was it intimidation or was it received with warmth and acceptance?
I really accepted it. I thought like, wow, I can actually use this to my advantage. I can actually even nurture some of my artists to use it and facilitate the creative process, you know, and ideas and whatnot. But other people were intimidated because they thought they were just toys and they were just a distraction. Mm. I never saw it that way.
It would have changed the business models as well, because you would have been able to leave a studio with a piece that you could take home and iterate and use it and change it at home and then come back into the studio. So the booking rates in the studios would have been affected. Because you could only play and use the stuff within that environment. Is that right?
Yeah, some people were intimidated because of that. basically. You know, they saw that it was going to be like an, it could signify an economic loss to them, you know, by not being in absolute control of the process, you know, like, okay, mm-hmm. you come to the studio, you do everything in the studio under my own terms, you know, that kind of attitude. Some people felt intimidated by that aspect, you know. That's why they actually tried to portray it as a distraction, kind of like, it's a tie, nothing good is going to come out of that, you know, it's not professional. Yeah. You know, I always laugh about that concept of how you label things to be professional or amateur, you know, or semi-pro, all of those. I never think in those terms. And even back then, I never thought in those terms, even though I'm really driven by technology and the kind of skills I acquire over the years. And some people try to defend that. That's not the main key to creation.
Yeah.
It's not the main key to creation.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because when I was in Sydney, I was recording my album back in, was it 08 or 09, in around that era. I can't even remember anymore. I'm getting old. And I thought Logic was a baby version of Pro Tools. It was marketed as being very, like, you know, childlike. And Chris Vallejo, who owns a great studio in Sydney called Linear Studios, was recording Empire of the Sun's Walking on a Dream. I don't know if it was a big hit in America, but it was a huge hit in Australia. And he played some of the tracks to me, and I was like, "You're using Logic?" And he's like, "Yeah, and they're using Logic." And I'm like, "Oh, no way." I was like, "I can get that, and I don't have any all this, you know, these problems with my Pro Tools and my Mac." And I was like, "Yeah." And I switched like that. It was literally that, because my perception, my model of how I thought of the program was fit for purpose. And it just opened up all these rooms to, like, sounds that I was like, oh, you know what I mean? It's amazing. Like, and it just changed how I wrote music from then on, Logic. Mm-hmm. One question I wanted to ask you. So back then, at that time, when we got to work together, your role as a producer, I remember you saying to me, and it was probably, I wasn't mature enough to understand it, you know, your role as a producer was to make the environment ready for the artist to work. And now, as a service designer, and I do a lot of workshop facilitation, I completely get that. I make the space open and safe for these ideas to emerge. And, you know, I guess looking back on that, how have you seen that the role of producer evolve? And how do you maintain that level of importance? Because it's such a critical thing for production of anything, to make sure that there's a safe space to try and fail. And if technology is, you know, obviously we're in the middle of a pandemic and you're using Skype and Zoom and all these kind of different technologies to try and connect, how do you get around that?
I think that you have to always, you know, keep in mind what the ultimate goal is, number one.
Hmm.
You need to always have an eye on the goal. On the ultimate goal, you know, of the effort that you're going through, but without forgetting any point during the process that everything is important. Everything is important.
Mm.
That's the problem I'm having with some people, that that you can only learn through experience, obviously, you know, to give the right importance to even some of the little details that other people might just disregard, right? You have to be connected to the process. You have to be connected to the people you are working with. Empathy is just so important to, you know, to truly understand what they are going through. And then you can spot right away what's going to work and what's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And people even doubt you sometimes, but they go like, "Are you sure?" Like, but it's clear to you because you have gone through those experiences so many times. You connect with that person. You have the empathy to know. Yeah. Sort of like interpret what's going through their head, and then you know what's going to be the best move from that point on. So it's an ever-changing process. It's not static. That's what people need to understand. It's not static. It can change every 5 minutes or every second, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I'm going through that right now, actually, with two of the artists I'm producing. Things are changing emotionally for them. But you have to... Even through the distance, you have to be connected. You have to use whatever tools you have. You mentioned, you know, Zoom, Skype, whatever tools you might have, you have to be able to...
Connect.
To connect, yeah.
So do you create time to pick up the phone and speak to them and
Absolutely.
Learn?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. To learn what they're going through, you know, to learn, never assume anything. You know, we might have worked on some songs and approved on some moves like 5 months ago. Maybe that doesn't stand anymore.
Yeah.
That's not the case anymore. You have to stay connected.
Does it take longer to create now? Or have you seen technology as being an enabler for speed?
I think it's an enabler for speed. And even not just the internet technology, but the basic, you know, speed of the systems now, you know, technology itself, you know, by itself, even old technology, you know, now it's more efficient. We can jump from one idea to another, like efficiently, like quickly. We can open several projects at the same time. It's not like we used to have to wait. Not anymore. I mean, things move fast. We can collaborate super fast too through so many internet tools, even full sessions, you know, even the fact of the speed of the internet, of the uploads, downloads, everything helps. Everything has.
Yeah, look, I totally agree. I can see all that kind of stuff. But what have we lost in all the speed? You mentioned the human aspect.
The human aspect, human interaction. So we have to be very, very careful to dedicate enough time to still have, you know, that aspect always on the table for every project we work on. That's why I still love to and want to meet people, you know, even in 5 minutes of looking to each other eye to eye, you can solve more issues than, interacting, you know, same thing when you are mixing. For example, you can go back and forth sending your mix, your MP3s or WAV files, you know, over the internet. They listen to it, they get back to you. Mm-hmm. And you can spend days, weeks, you know, fine-tuning a mix, doing little changes. But if you connect live with them and they actually can go through the experience with you, there is a different level of reassurance and a different level of exploration, even in the fine details that you can never do any otherwise, because you open the door to everybody second guessing about the possibilities. You know, you have something that you love, but you are still second guessing what the possibilities might be if we do this other thing or if we do that. And sometimes you don't even need to do it, but you need to talk about it.
Yeah.
That's enough to create that reassurance and actually create direction. We always have to be very, very careful that no matter what we do, we need to create direction. We need to make our choices. Every moment of the process, we have to make our choices. We cannot procrastinate them forever. That's not creation. I mean, that's a very absurd way and a very difficult way to create. And I've been on that process too. I've been on that road in the past. And I'll rather do it the other way. Yeah.
So when you're creating, like you create different versions of the track, is it? And you send it back to the artist for, is this kind of what you're looking for? And what's the involvement then, I guess, with the record label to ensure that, you know, that they're going in the right direction?
That's another important aspect. You know, we don't just do it for the artist. We're the middle person between everybody involved. And everybody involved is the record label, even the management, because these days, all of the, you know, recording projects are actually being executive produced by management companies, not just record labels, but management companies under the supervision of the record label, but they're actually being executed by managers and whatnot. So there are many players on the equation. There is you as the producer, then there is the record label. Obviously, the most important is the artist. Everything starts with the artist, but then underneath it, there is the record label, the management, and then you as the producer. And it's your responsibility to coordinate the full effort.
The requests.
Because you are the one executing anyway. So you cannot depend on other people giving you just vague ideas. You have to actually decipher through all everybody's ideas and try to come to compromises.
Yeah.
There's always some level of compromise here and there. It has to do even with the silly aspects of things. You know, like you create a song with the artist or you help him create a song and it runs for 4 minutes and 50 seconds and then the label needs it to be 3.5 minutes. You know, I mean, even in the little you think like, oh, that's a minor aspect. Well, it's not a minor detail for the artist. He put all of that effort to create that song the way it is.
Mm.
So you become the little person.
How are they doing that? How are they, one, cutting through all that stuff to make sure that what the final product is going to be a hit? How are they validating that? What things are they doing to make sure that when, I know you worked at Lady Gaga and that big album that my wife still plays, that I try to drown out with my U2 albums. But I like all the music apart from U2, but it's a bit of a joke now in this episode, so I'll continue it. But, you know, how do they make sure that, like, okay, this is going to be a hit? Because you hear them, like when I wrote it, I knew it was a hit. I'm like, did you? Like, how do they know?
Not everybody knows that. I mean, they claim that after the fact. It's very it's very simple to make those claims after the fact, right? And you don't hear about the ones that put a lot of effort on it and then it never became a success. You never you never hear them talking about it, like going like, oh yeah, when I wrote this, I knew it wasn't gonna be a hit, right? Yeah. That's not a story.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we only hear about the success stories, and obviously, after the fact, it's very, very simple to talk about it in the terms. But you know, it's patterns. It's all about patterns. One pattern is creating something that's recognizable, something that's familiar, that you know feels familiar to you, even though it's something new, but feels familiar to it. That's one of the patterns that executive producers, record labels, A&R people. And some artists, you know, as songwriters, recognize as the, you know, as a great element, you know, grab into, you know. But other than that, what's the formula for success? And also keep in mind that many of the successes happen because of the big marketing effort put behind them. If those songs were only played 10 times a week on radio, they will have never become a success, but they are being played 2,000 times a week on radio. Well, there is something to it too.
Yeah. So they're being paid to play them as well. So it's like there's a huge marketing budget from the labels behind to push them and make them a success. But do they do things like listening parties to validate? They do those things as well. Like, so.
Well, yeah, we have always done that. We have always done that. That was always part of the process. Even bringing the whole marketing team, you know, to a listening session and doing blind listening sessions, you know, without anybody commenting on any of the songs, and then having one, even with the artist or with the producer, explaining what those specific songs and moments mean, you know, trying to make it a more meaningful, you know, listening experience. And then you have, sometimes you get two completely different answers, even from the same people. So both are equally important. I think that, I go through the same process. Very often when I work with an artist, I tell them first, just send me the songs. Don't tell me anything about them. I listen to them. I make my own notes. I come to my own conclusions. Then next step, let's meet up. Let's listen again. But you tell me about your songs. You tell me about your meaning, you know, what they mean to you.
Then, I remember this.
Then you grasp a different aspect of the song, actually.
Absolutely. It's an important aspect. Now, look, I know we're conscious of time and, you know, you're very busy these days. But you mentioned there something around the role of AI. And now we're at this point in time where we think, you know, we've mentioned about the evolution of technology and how GarageBand and, you know, MySpace and the iPod and all that kind of stuff in the mid 2000s had a huge effect. But now we're at this point, we're mid pandemic, or hopefully mid pandemic. We could be at the start of the pandemic. Who knows? But where are we at, and how do you think technology is going to change the next, say, 2 to 5 years? What are your predictions?
I think that technology is going to further assist in every step of the process, especially songwriting, even songwriting.
How? Tell us.
But songwriting, I think that that pattern recognition I was talking about, but when you link that pattern
to
your subject, you know, it's like, AI can actually gather the data from whatever information you feed it, right? It can be at a micro level, is more demographic or localized demographic, or it can be as a, you know, pan out perspective of the world, of taste, cultural aspects, many things. But when you actually have two different projections and you can actually come up with a compromised pattern, that's when he's going to be able to assist the user. Yeah. You know, you as a user are not just going to go for the generic pattern that everybody, you know, is after, but it's a mix of the generic pattern and your own personal, you know, taste, your own personal, basically. I think that's where AI is going to become really interesting. And it's not just going to be about musical taste. Music is not just music. Music is everything. Even your, I'm going to say something crazy, but even your political preference is important. I don't know, everything comes into play in the way you write your songs, and not just talking about the lyrics. I mean, it influences every single aspect of what you do, how you conduct your life, how you even brush your teeth. I don't know, everything interplays. So I think that's where AI over time is going to become a super personalized assistant.
You could have, imagine the API coming out of Spotify and being able to, you know, cross-reference that with the Facebook API and saying, well, 12 to 14-year-old people in France, like, this is the kind of most popular music and this is the most popular groove, and you're creating a music for that demographic and that target audience. You know, you could create something like that. So you could use it as a research tool. But yeah, what's really interesting is what you mentioned there around it, almost like an instrument, and, you know, how it can actually improve that process. That's where it's scary.
And if you could even calibrate, you know, the AI, you could tell the AI what level of influence you need. What percentage of influence you need in the creation process, you know?
Yeah, dial it up, dial it down.
At this level, you know, you create like a threshold of...
like autopilot. Oh, Rafa's not in the studio today. Turn it up to 100%. It's, you know, it is kind of crazy. To think that we could be at that point where AI could almost create some sort of music for us. Because have you seen that Nirvana track that went out recently where they let AI create a Nirvana track based on In Utero and Nevermind? Have you seen it?
Yeah. Somebody mentioned, I haven't seen it myself.
I'll throw a link in the show notes for this.
Somebody mentioned it to me, yeah.
I listened to it and I was like, yeah, this is gonna be rubbish. And then I was like, it's kind of cool. It sounds like a Nirvana song, but all the lyrics are kind of muddled together from their hits. But it's interesting. Like, Rafa, I could, you know, I have spoken to you for hours and days, but if people want to reach out to you, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you and stay in touch with what you're doing?
I think my website, you know,
RafaSardina.com.
Sardina.com, yeah, that's the easiest way.
And you are on Instagram. You know, you are a bit of a prolific Instagrammer. You've got your, you know, hands full. You're going to be busy 2020. So anyone interested in music production and in that space, Rafa is always giving great online webinars as well. So I've seen some of their stuff. I think I attended one of them, actually. All those difficult questions that came from Ireland were from me. So, Rafa, thanks so much for your time. It was great speaking with you.
Thank you. It was really, really great talking to you.
So there you have it. That's all for this episode of Bringing Design Closer. If you like this episode, feel free to visit thisis8cd.com, where you can access our back catalogue of over 100 episodes, with episodes related to service design, product management, design research, and much, much more. And if you're interested in design and innovation training, feel free to check out our business, thisisdoing.com, where you can join online classrooms and learn from the world's best design and innovation leaders. Join the This Is 8CD newsletter, where you'll receive updates from the network, and also, if you're interested, apply to join the Slack community on thisis8cd.com. Stay safe, and until next time, take care.